This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Colorado's Jared Polis might be the most libertarian governor in America at a time when his big state Democratic counterparts are getting exposed as hypocrites while presiding over historic population declines. Think California's Gavin Newsom, or getting kicked out of office for sexual harassment and sending COVID-infected patients back to nursing homes and then lying about it. Think New York's Andrew Cuomo. I'm not sure that Polis's 2014 claim in the pages of Reason that libertarians should vote for Democratic candidates because they're more supportive of individual liberty and freedom is held up, but he's certainly leading by example. The 46-year-old governor is presiding over one of the fastest-growing states in the country and a place that had one of the lowest death rates during the pandemic. He pushed back against members of his own party to remove mask mandates, and he has consistently argued that public health decisions should be made at as local a level as possible. Last fall, at a conference held by the conservative Steamboat Institute, he declared that the state income tax rate should be zero, and he supported ballot initiatives that have reduced the rate. Polis has embraced occupational licensing reform and was an outspoken defender of Bitcoin back in 2014 when Joe Manchin called on Janet Yellen to ban it. The openly gay, married father of two recently signed a free-range parenting bill that effectively re-legalizes the sort of Colorado childhood he recalls as the son of two ex-hippie parents. Just because a kid is playing alone outside, it doesn't mean they're in danger, Polis said at the signing ceremony. It'll help decrease false reports so we can focus on the serious and the real instances of child abuse. As conservative states pass laws strictly limiting abortions, he signed legislation guaranteeing a woman's right to choose. The founder of a couple of charter schools, he's an outspoken advocate for school choice, too, saying earlier this year that public school choice is an asset to improve all public schools. A former tech entrepreneur and a five-term congressman, Polis is steadfast against limiting speech rights or treating social media platforms as utilities that can't moderate content or bounce users for transgressing terms of service. In a wide-ranging conversation with me, Polis talks about trying to govern from the middle, take shots at Joe Biden's presidency over free trade and immigration, and repeats his argument that libertarians should vote for Democrats. Up for re-election in the fall and a heavy favorite to win a second term, Polis also discusses his political ambitions as a rising star in a party that is expected to get blown out in the midterm elections. Here is the Reason interview with Governor Jared Polis. Governor Polis, thanks for talking to Reason.
Nick, always a pleasure. It's great to see you.
You recently signed a reasonable independence law for children. And as you were signing it, you said just because a child is playing alone outside, it doesn't mean they're in danger. Explain what this law was about and what was the issue that it was addressing.
Yeah, this has to do with the broad area of parental rights. And it's very reasonable to raise your child in different ways. Some parents are helicopter parents, right, where they watch your kid every moment at the playground. And, you know, these people can argue that's good, that's bad. Other parents want their kid to, you know, go two blocks from their home, play on the playground and return home by dinner. Those are all acceptable ways to parent. I mean, you shouldn't have to. The government shouldn't be telling you how to parent. I mean, there's real things like child abuse, right? I mean, there's a legitimate government interest in preventing child abuse, but letting your kid play on the playground, not child abuse. And there were these incidents.
It seems to me like what you're doing here is re-legalizing childhood. People of our rough age were not just allowed to play outside by our parents; we were forced to. What happened to American childhood that we are, you know, now asking the government to babysit our kids every second of the day, and then to call the cops if you see a kid playing even in their front yard outside?
Yeah, and that's what was happening, and it does happen across the country, is parents would get caught up in child protected services just because somebody saw their, you know, 8-year-old playing on a playground two blocks from where they live. And inevitably, the parents would obviously not lose custody and it would be fine. But like, who wants to get caught up in child protective services? So we wanted to be clear that, like, in fact, yes, your kids can play alone. It's reasonably safe. That's how kids learn. They explore. I used to hike, you know, in the mountains near my home when I was, you know, 10 with a friend, you know, I mean, without parents. So So all of that. I don't know what's happening culturally, but we're not saying the government should put our foot on the scale either way. I mean, if parents want to be helicopter parents, that's their prerogative too. But as a parent myself, you probably saw my son just walk through the door back there. Yeah, I mean, I have no issue if they want to play in a local playground, and we're, you know, we do that kind of where we walk the dog in the in one area, there's a dog park, and they play on the playground, you know, a couple hundred yards
I
away.
I hope that's kind of free range parenting, you know, kind of, it shouldn't have to be enforced by law or ensconced in law, but I hope it starts to spread. Other things I want to, I want to talk to you about a wide range of areas where you're really drawing bipartisan support for things. Sometimes that changes a little bit. You also recently signed a powerful, unequivocal statement in favor of women's bodily autonomy in Colorado. You signed a law saying that a woman has a right to an abortion. Are there any limits on that? And what was pressing you to say that?
Yeah. So what's pressing us to do this and other states is what's happening nationally, which is very scary, in that Roe versus Wade is all but overturned and effectively will be overturned. This nationally protected a woman's right to bodily autonomy. And it's about more than abortion, to be clear. It's about assisted reproduction. It's about having kids, through IVF, all of those things. We simply put the Roe versus Wade precedent into Colorado law. So no matter what happens nationally, it should be between a woman, her doctor, her faith. The government should not be at that table in deciding whether you complete a pregnancy or whether you get pregnant.
Does the state have any interest more broadly in restricting or regulating abortion as, a woman comes closer to carrying a baby to term?
Well, look, neither me nor you, since we're not women, would never be in the shoes of a woman who's, 8 months pregnant. They found out their child has a major brain defect and will be stillborn or die within moments of death. What a horrible choice for a woman to have. But of course, the government should not say we're forcing you to carry this non-viable fetus to term. I mean, that is reprehensible. There is no shame on the woman either way. Some women might decide because of their faith to go ahead and do that, and that's gut-wrenching for the woman. Some woman might decide to terminate the pregnancy. That's also gut-wrenching. But it is their decision, not yours and not mine.
How have Republicans or conservatives in Colorado, which back in the day was pretty liberal. I mean, there was a time, when being pro-abortion was actually a Republican position or it was within the party. How are conservatives and Republicans in Colorado responding to this?
Well, first of all, I think there's, and you call it, pro-abortion. I don't think those of us who are pro-choice are in any way pro-abortion. In fact, policies espoused generally by Democrats, which means birth control, which means sex education, these reduce the number of abortions. And the number of abortions has, in fact, decreased during my governorship. And as I've said to many folks that consider themselves pro-life, I say, when you make something illegal, it doesn't mean it goes away. Look at the failed alcohol prohibition policy in Colorado. We were one of the first states to eliminate the failed marijuana prohibition policy. Did marijuana use go up? No, it didn't, especially among young people. We probably see it more, but no, prohibition doesn't work. So let's meet people where they at. Let's make sure we respect people's bodily autonomy. And yes, there were many on the conservative side, the Republican side, that do believe that we should have a government overreach here and that government should be making these decisions, not women, not in consultation with their faith or with doctors, but that decision should be made for them.
I just want to point out, I say pro-abortion because I'm pro-choice and I don't think there is anything wrong with abortion. So, I also accuse right-wingers of being anti-abortion because they are. It's not about choice for them.
I think the important thing to point out, Nick, is there's room in the pro-choice tent for people who are anti-abortion as well.
Absolutely.
Because they can say, I would never do it. I believe it's murder under my faith. I'm Catholic, whatever it is, but I don't want to force that on some other person.
No, and you're right that under the rubric of legal abortion, abortion rights have been coming down since Roe versus Wade, essentially. So gun rights are an interesting question for somebody like you, because you are not against gun rights in a way that, a kind of stereotypical coastal Democrat might be. You recently signed legislation that was bipartisan that said that people guilty of 110 different felonies are banned from owning guns. Talk a little bit about that, that specific law, and then also your general take on gun rights.
Yeah. First of all, I support the Second Amendment, our right to bear arms. It's in our Constitution. It's a question of what are, you know, how far does that go? So, you know, you get really, and I'll get to the one you talked about in a second. Let me talk about one other one first. We call it red flag laws, which, so there is a very high bar, as there should be, for somebody being involuntarily committed because they're in immediate danger to themselves or others, right? Super high bar. So the question here, is there a slightly lower bar where they would temporarily lose access to their guns and then they get it back a few months later, but it still goes before a judge? So that's what we did there. It's, you know, if somebody's in a dangerous mental state, not quite at the level where they're committed, is there something short of commitment where, you know, where a loved one can intervene and a parent can say to a 19-year-old for, you know, 3 months, your guns are going to go away. So that's what that one is. This one is, you know, obviously for gun-related crimes, you lose your rights for a period of life. This is a question of what if for other violent crimes. These are violent crimes. At what stage? And it's a reasonable discussion either way. I mean, I don't come to it with a particular bias. It's one of those things where what do you strike the balance of what crime you commit that causes you to lose those rights? People do that for voting rights too. They say, what level of crime do you lose your voting rights for? What level of crime do you lose your right to bear arms for? Those kinds of things are, there's no right or wrong answer, but there, and I don't like the hyperbole on either side either. I think it's just, let's just try to figure this out. What is the right answer? I'm not coming to the table saying I know it, but what is a reasonable punishment? And by the way, in my pardons that I've done, the highest number of pardons, Nick, have been people who have basically lost their right to bear arms because of something 20 or 30 years ago that they did when they were young. They've lived an exemplary life since, but they can't go hunting with their kids and they can't have a gun for home defense. And I generally have given probably a dozen or two pardons, but that's a very cumbersome process for somebody to request that.
Are you channeling the 70s, you know, kind of a Colorado 70s or a kind of American 70s, where it did seem like a lot of lifestyle, you know, we can talk about the 60s as, you know, a kind of a moment when America cracked open, but a lot of personal liberties were really expanded in the 70s, gay rights, women's rights, abortion rights. Certainly gun rights started to come online and things like that. Is, you know, children's rights, I mean, to play outside, that's you know, is that part of where you're coming out of? And, you know, where does it go next then?
I would say culturally, you know, my parents were legit hippies. That's who they were in the 70s. They were anti-war demonstrators. They were, you know, hippies. They considered joining a commune, but didn't because the commune was sexist and anti-women. So, you know, that's kind of the culture milieu that I grew up in. I respect freedom. I think that it's great that Colorado has people that are deeply religious and conservative, as long as they don't enforce their values on others. We have people that are very, hedonistic. I mean, you name it. I mean, it's great because you can you're free to be the way you want. That's the way it should be. And you know, we were the first state to legalize marijuana. I'm very proud of it. I don't use marijuana, Nick. It's just a choice. I don't really drink either. But like, that's totally somebody's choice. And in Colorado, you don't risk getting in trouble with the law just because you want to smoke marijuana.
You have a couple of cities there that are also expanding, you know, the use of ethnogenic plants or, you know, magic mushrooms and things like that. Do you see that coming? Is that the next state level legalization that you see coming in Colorado for drugs?
It may be on the ballot this year. Denver already, and I say may because it's a people's initiative process. I don't know whether they're going to gather the signatures. But yeah, Denver already did. We generally, and I generally don't think that things like that should be dealt with through a criminal setting. In fact, what you're talking about in particular might have some therapeutic uses around people that are trying to get off of opioids or people that have major issues with depression or anxiety. There's some clinical studies that have been done. And frankly, the clinical studies are inhibited by the illegality of some of the substances. So it's very frustrating. We had that with marijuana as well, where it was very difficult to even do research on what the benefits might be in particular circumstances because it couldn't be done with federally funded research.
You know, it's we're taping this on Monday, April 18th, tax day. You have stated that your preferred state income tax rate is zero. More specifically, let me ask, how do you get there or how do you approach that? And is that, you know, what is the special sauce in a purple state, which is, you know, the your party, the Democrats have taken over the state legislature or took it over in 2019. But what is the special sauce of reducing the drag on the economy by taxes and regulation in a way that grows the economy and gives people more opportunity while also maintaining, you know, a growth that is sustainable?
We've cut the income tax twice since I've been in office. When I came in, it was 4.63%. Now it's 4.55%. It went to 4.5 in between. We also cut property taxes for 2 years. We'll need to renew some of that. And we've cut a number of other taxes and fees. I think the secret sauce is very simple, Nick, on getting rid of the income tax. And it's one that neither, you know, somebody whose inherent objective is to shrink government or somebody whose inherent objective is to grow government won't necessarily like, but it's still the right thing to do. It's to say, let's take those arguments off the table because we don't have a majority for those. Let's call it revenue neutral. So this is not a backdoor plot to increase the size of government, not a backdoor plot to decrease the size of government. Let's just say, how do we fund government and separately have a discussion about, of course, how we can make it more efficient, shrink it. Let's figure out how to do that. But in this particular discussion, let's find income is not a good thing to tax because it taxes productivity. As a society, we like income. We want people to make income. Find something that is a negative externality or is a bad thing and instead tax that. And so I often talk about pollution or carbon as the basis of taxation instead of income. So if we can sort of say this is a discussion about tax reform and what we should tax, not the discussion we're having right now about whether government should be bigger or smaller, we're taking the same revenue neutral. Let's then move the basis of taxation from income to something else like pollution or carbon.
Yeah, when you talk about pollution or carbon, though, does that create weird incentives where suddenly, you're taking one part of the economy and saying, okay, you guys pay for everything else? How do you do that in a way where the carbon tax or a pollution tax or some other externality tax doesn't just become kind of a growing swamp that you can just funnel more and more money and punish more and more things you don't like it?
You're absolutely right. In fact, another thing an economist would say, so I say trust the science, right, in all things. And you hear this as a talking point for left or right. It's frustrating. But that means when you're talking about taxation, trust the science of economics. There's a whole body of science around that. And yes, another tenet would be a broad-based tax is much better because it creates less distortions than a narrowly focused tax that's much higher for the same amount of revenue. So you're absolutely right. That's a concern. So you want to look at, in general, I think income is one of the best things that people can have. So I don't think we should tax it. Consumption, reasonable to tax, right? There's issues around how you make sure it's not regressive because somebody who makes, $10 million simply can't consume and spend as a higher percentage of their income as somebody who makes $50,000. But I'm all for maybe it's a luxury tax on items above a certain amount of additional 1%, whatever it is. Consumption, reasonable to discourage. I mean, I'm not against consumption, but it's not as good a thing as income. So consumption, and yes, pollution, but you're absolutely right. How do you make sure it's not so narrowly focused that it's one type of pollution and not others? It's not an easy thing. One of my favorite sayings that I always apply to politics is, if it was easy, it would have been done already, right? So I'm not afraid to have that discussion. I would love to, and look, in practice, I'm happy reducing the income tax if we can't eliminate it. And we've done that twice. But I think that there's a discussion to be had about how do you find a broad-based tax that fundamentally looks at negative or neutral externalities and punishes them rather than punishes income and value right. creation.
Democrats have a reputation as the big spending party. And, we can argue about, certainly the Republicans, at least at the national level, are also big spenders. But with increasing Democratic control of the Colorado legislature and government, Is it reasonable to worry that government is going to start to grow? Your budget proposal for this year, you increased the budget a bit, like about 4% over last year. I mean, is it kind of now one narrative would be, well, you guys are in control now and you're going to start growing the size, scope and spending of government? Is that accurate?
Well, so yeah, in Colorado, and I support this, any increase in revenue goes to the ballot. It can only be approved by the voters. So the state legislature doesn't really have fiscal policy. The budget went up because we got more revenues, right, at the same static tax rate. And obviously inflation means it's not that's not a real increase. It's a nominal increase. But I think we can certainly keep up with where inflation is. I would add that one of the nefarious ways that that Republicans generally support big government is through special interest tax loopholes. They do it on the tax side. Democrats tend to create distortions on the expenditure side, but they're economically equivalent. So for instance, I was very proud that we were able to roll back some special interest tax breaks for insurers, for coal companies, even for college savings accounts, which I'm totally for saving for college, but why would you have a government preference for that? We didn't eliminate them, but we reduced the number that people would get a state tax deduction on their 529 saving account. So, and what did we do with that? We've created a larger surplus that can go to reducing taxes and fees. So I think, again, one of the fallacies that I think some partisan Republicans have is they say as a speaking point, we're for reducing the size and scope of government. But when they put in preferential tax treatment for certain industries or certain special interests, it is every bit the economic effect of a subsidy.
Before we continue with the Reason interview, I want to tell you about a fantastic Reason event that takes place on Monday, May 2nd in New York City. We're going to be doing a live taping of this very podcast at Manhattan's Caveat Bar and Theater with Faisal Saeed Al-Matar and Melissa Chen, the co-founders of a group called Ideas Beyond Borders. It's a nonprofit that translates books about pluralism, science, civil liberties, and critical thinking, like John Stuart Mill's On Liberty and Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now, into Arabic, and then distributes them for free as ebooks throughout the Middle East and beyond. They've also translated thousands of Wikipedia pages on similar topics and made them available to an audience that is desperately interested in new ways of thinking about culture, politics, and ideas. Faisal left Iraq after extremists killed his brother and threatened his life. And Melissa was once a persona non grata in her native Singapore due to free speech activism. They'll explain how they work to prevent extremism and cancel culture in the West as well as the East. Founded 5 years ago, Ideas Beyond Borders is also actively helping Afghans find refuge from the Taliban and is running a global campaign against censorship at endbannedbooks.org. This is going to be a great evening of conversation and camaraderie, so come on out on Monday, May 2nd if you're in the New York area. Tickets are just $10. You can get them and details at reason.com/events. And now, back to the Reason interview with Governor Jared Polis.
Your COVID response has gotten generally high marks, and Colorado did pretty well. No state came out unscathed, obviously. But can you talk about, you know, following the science on that? Because you seem to be leading the movement towards getting rid of masks when they were either no longer necessary or recognized as not being as effective as thought. What went into your COVID policy, and how much blowback did you get from your own party or people kind of on the liberal side of the equation?
So first, I think the key thing that every governor should have done, hopefully, that is to say, what is the state interest here? What are we doing? Is the state interest to save every life? Look at what China is doing, right? Not working very well. We define the state interest very early on. We do not want to overwhelm our hospital capacity, because what that would mean is not only would more COVID people die, but you could have a heart attack, a stroke, not be able to get cancer treatment. So we said, we will not overwhelm our hospital capacity. And we succeeded in doing that. So we wanted to manage the pandemic in a way and had the mitigation when we needed it to avoid overwhelming our hospitals. And yes, at a relatively early stage, we said, masks, first of all, this is again where it was frustrating because some Republican governors almost were channeling a message, I don't like mask wearing. I was very clear during the heights of the pandemic, I wore a mask, right? It didn't mean I wanted to force it on people, but as a model and as a sign, absolutely, it would reduce your risk, not eliminate your risk, but reduce your risk. Vaccination, same thing. It reduces your risk. I got it. I encourage everybody to get it. So I think there was some mismanagement on both sides. Again, you mentioned there were certainly some that kept too tight controls in for too long, but there were also some that catered to misinformation and disinformation that had a human toll and a toll on the economy. So we tried to avoid both of those pitfalls here. I can't imagine anybody got everything perfect, but I certainly did my best every day.
What are your thoughts on state versus federal control? Because in a way, Donald Trump, an odd figure who, may or may not ever be, talked about in the future again as a candidate. But in a way, he gave the states a lot of freedom to kind of pursue their own course. Do you think ultimately that was a good discovery process? Or do you think that more power to kind of set the policy and tone of COVID and other kind of related public health issues, should that be emanating from Washington?
Here in Colorado, and I think in many other states, we're certainly not alone in doing this, we actually took it a step further and really devolved to local authority. And so we had a very different approach in some of our, big blue cities and some of our rural areas. And we actually have conservative cities too, like Colorado Springs went away from mask wearing very early. That's more of a moderate conservative city. So we left it in local hands. Why? Because these are real trade-offs, Nick. I mean, I think as governor, it was very clear, there's not a right answer. It's about how you weigh the additional risks with the importance of everyday activities and freedom that people have. And who best to make that decision but the level of government closest to the people. And I thought it was not a a bug, but an asset that we had communities across Colorado that were handling it in ways that was culturally and socio-politically appropriate for the people that governed and elected them. And so we really tried to empower people early on to do that. And yes, did it frustrate some people in our cities that didn't want anybody wearing masks? Did it frustrate some people in our conservative areas that wanted everyone wearing a mask? It did, but it frustrated less people. But more importantly, more people had buy-in because it was a level of government closest to the people that was weighing those trade-offs and making the very difficult decisions that they faced.
Your past as a businessman is in the tech industry, which is, you know, clearly the most demonized sector kind of currently going on, or that we're talking about. What do you think about attempts to regulate social media platforms as, you know, a sort of public utility? And at various points, laws in the Colorado legislature have been floated to kind of identify hate speech and ban it or punish platforms. You know, is that a good way forward?
The government needs to tread very, very lightly when it comes to any speech-based regulation of tech or any other industry. I would say federally, there is a role for antitrust law. Now, we can have a whole discussion on that. You don't want to overdo that. That's when there's a competitive advantage that protects the entrenched incumbent and it can block others from getting in. I would argue it's a very competitive space when you talk about social media in general. You know, if somebody offers a better service, they'll get there. There's a number of vibrant different services. If somebody has a better search than Google, there's nothing to stop people from going over and using that. But that's the realm it should be had. When it comes to speech, the only real actionable item should be the same as we do, you know, a direct threat, right? I mean, I will kill so-and-so. That is actionable, is illegal. But other speech that can be construed, misinformation, disinformation, political speech, it should be refuted if it's misinformation or disinformation, but there's not a government role in banning that.
What do you think is going on that tech, you know, went from being, you know, certainly in the run-up to the tech bubble at the very least, but even then for, you know, the aughts, it seemed like the tech industry was going to be our savior. It was bringing us a lot of nice, shiny things at great prices, you know, new variety. It really seems to be in the doghouse. What is behind the ongoing kind of vilification of the tech industry as a continuing source of bad things in American culture?
Well, if you want to see a great socio-political commentary on that, look up Bo Burnham. Have you seen his Inside piece? I think that, you know, we all had this very aspirational view of what this kind of new communication technology can bring. But like anything, it revealed more of ourselves to one another, which means the good, the bad, and the ugly. As a student of human nature, I don't think it's inherently evil or inherently good. I think all those facets are reflected in each and every one of us. And certainly the advances in technology have magnified all of that, magnified the good, right? I mean, it's amazing to see the acts of goodwill from strangers, the GoFundMes that help people get the medical care they need. Even something simple like me and my son are making kefir at home and to learn how to, on Reddit, to get the kefir grains, and I did rock tumbling. But also, yes, the ugly and the misinformation, the disinformation, the neo-Nazism, the far-right conspiracies. It doesn't change who we are. It just magnifies it.
Yeah. We're kind of in a moment now as a country where we seem not to have a ruling narrative of who we are as Americans, what we aspire to, you know, in a shared way, in a collective way that is not repressive, but inclusive. You know, at various points, America defined itself as a nation of immigrants or a creedal nation where, you know, people came here and were able to be individuals and kind of maximize or, you know, actualize themselves. Right now, we seem to be in a particularly nasty period of identity politics. It takes a form on the right. It takes probably a more obvious form on the left of, you know, belonging to different categories and then getting to speak or to kind of commandeer conversations depending on what group you represent. What needs to happen to get us out of this kind of moment of polarization and really contempt for each other to get, you know, what's a model for a vision of an America which would be inclusive and positive and generative in terms of growing, you know, what we're all able to do?
You know, I wish I had the answers to that, Nick. I think you framed the problem correctly. Look, our experiment as a republic, we're about a quarter of a millennia old. We'll be 250 years old in just a couple more years. I think that means it's time for our awkward adolescence. I think it's a time for rediscovering who we are, absolutely, legitimately, and the left is right on this, coming to terms with legacies of slavery and racism that absolutely existed, and pretending that they didn't doesn't serve anybody. And then, of course, on the right, understanding that there's not some collective guilt today for what might have happened 100 or 200 years ago. It's important to be honest about it. But just by being honest about what your great grandfather might have done doesn't mean that you have culpability. We don't believe in blood guilt in our country. And so there's just a lot of rhetoric on both sides. It's hurtful to this, but I think gradually there'll be something that kind of builds out from the middle that leads to a higher level of understanding as we emerge from adolescence into our hopefully wise adult years, where we preserve the tenets of liberal democracy and our rights and free enterprise.
What's your sense of state level gag orders in the educational sphere that will either, dictate what is allowable speech in a K-12 classroom or a K-3 classroom about sexual orientation or identity, say in Florida, or, every state pretty much has these laws floating around. What's your take on that kind of, public education is going to reflect the polity of people, but at what level should that be, kind of hammered out?
Again, the level of government closest to the people, the local level, we have locally elected school boards, we have charter schools that are self-governing with their own board, and they handle these issues in the best way, that their parents want. And it's sort of an extension of parental rights. We have school choice in Colorado, public school choice. I realize, some also think it should include private school choice, but we have public school choice. You go to any school you want, charter, public, your district, other district. So if you don't like what's being shopped in your neighborhood school, the point is there's alternatives. You can go to whatever other school you want. And again, I think it's about people's comfort zone and what they want. Of course, these statewide gag orders are indefensible. I mean, to say you can't talk about something is absurd, because these are things, I'm a gay parent with my husband and we have two kids in school. What does that mean? My kid can't say my two dads want this. It's just as bizarre incursion on not only free speech, but on our rights as parents. Don't forget, I mean, single parents, gay parents, grandparents raising their kids, they have rights too. It's not only, and yes, the majority of kids have a mom and a dad. That's great and wonderful. But we love every kind of family and every kind of kid, and kids don't get to choose what kind of family they're born into. So I think hopefully we can emerge to more honest discussion about this. Certainly local control, but also the key sort of, again, these are state-funded schools. The key public interest, state interest in this is every kid should be welcomed as a learner. No kid should ever be turned away because of their race, their gender, who their parents are, who they are, any of that, because, again, as a public interest, absolutely they have access to publicly funded education.
Colorado is a state that is growing. It was growing before you became governor, but it's continuing to grow. Talk broadly about immigration. And can you, what are the benefits of immigration? You're obviously experiencing it at the state level in Colorado, but what about at the international level? We're in a moment where both parties, major parties, seem to be kind of down on immigration. What's good about immigration and how should we be dealing with it?
Immigration and getting rid of tariffs, free trade, are the two biggest things we can do to fight inflation right now. Bigger than monetary policy, bigger than whatever you think about government spending. You can get to tariffs in a minute, but they're directly inflationary by their very presence. But you know what people talk about and complain about? Shortages in the labor market now. It's all contrived. We do not have, if we simply fixed our immigration system and we're able to have a legal way where people could come here and take jobs that we can't fill, the whole situation would be solved and our economy would thrive and would be even more prosperous. So absolutely. And by the way, we don't even necessarily need to let in more immigrants. We simply need to give paperwork to the people who are already here today and forced to function at a suboptimal economic level because they don't have their proper documentation. So let's have a way to register, get right with the law, be here legally going forward. If they're on the right, they're saying, oh, Democrats are trying to get them to vote and become citizens. You know what? Just say that's 20 years they have to be here before they become citizens, whatever it is. Just give them, they're here for the right to work. They want to work and support themselves. They're not trying to vote a certain way or anything else. So absolutely, let's give provisional work permits to people that are already here. If we need to let more in, absolutely. No, I'm not open borders, right? I think it should match our need here. But we're so far on one side right now, we clearly need people to fill jobs and help grow our economy.
You are looking like you have an easy path to reelection. And obviously, you're never going to admit that, which is wise. But, you know, do you have ambitions for higher order? You know, in a couple of years ago, people on the Democratic side would have said, look, the 2024 nomination is going to be between Andrew Cuomo and Gavin Newsom. That's looking less and less likely. Do you want to run for president?
I don't, Nick. I really love Colorado, and I'm running for re-election this year in Colorado. Hopefully, I'll have another 4 years here. When that's done, my kids will be, 14 and 11. I really look forward to spending their, you know, high school years and junior high years with them. I served 10 years in Washington. I served my time there. Don't have any desire to go back. I really enjoyed serving in Congress. I was in the Liberty Caucus with my friend Justin Amash, and we did a lot of great fun work there. But that was my decade, and I'm proud to have done it for my country. But I'm even more excited personally to be back in beautiful Colorado.
What, you know, you have a definite libertarian streak in you, you know, as did Justin Amash. Where does that come from, and where should it go next? Where should libertarians be looking to kind of expand human freedom and flourishing within the, you know, the province of politics?
Certainly in both parties and in third parties too. I mean, you know, it's all over. So, I mean, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, whether you're a libertarian, it's important to find a voice for these issues and be at the table. Both major parties have their strengths and weaknesses. Libertarians' major weaknesses, they can never win any major elections, which is a pretty big weakness in a democracy. But I mean, how do you, I think you shouldn't hold back in being an advocate in whatever party you're in. And really also, I say this particularly to Republicans who are liberty-oriented, are you really in the right party? I mean, I know that you might not like this or that about the Democrats, but I think I actually published a piece in Reason about why libertarian-oriented voters should vote for, I can't remember which of our Democratic candidates was for president. It was maybe Hillary Clinton or one of those in one of those races, but over Donald Trump. And I would double down on that. Again, it's not arguing that Hillary Clinton was perfect or supported you, but you know, the alternative was an increasing authoritarianism, state favoritism, media. I mean, we've seen this route in Hungary. We've seen this route in other states. That's a more pressing danger than having somebody who might be center left who you may not agree with on every issue.
Are you happy with the Biden presidency so far?
I'm happy it restored rationality to government.
So I'm going to take that as a no, but...
Well, no, I'm thrilled that Donald Trump is no longer president. Absolutely. I'm thrilled that Donald Trump is no longer president.
Sure. But what about the way Biden is governing now? Is he causing inflation or abetting it? Is he, you know, how's he doing in foreign policy, things like that?
So, yeah, inflation is interesting, right? The government spending has a small effect that causes inflationary, yes, the monetary policy does. But I really believe that tariffs and immigration would solve inflation. It really would. It would wipe it out. And neither party is very good on that right now. Trump took a hard turn against TPP and trade deals and free trade, instituted tons of tariffs. Biden has slowly unwound a few, but hasn't really committed to it. Immigration, Trump was awful, the worst. Biden a little better, but I wish much better. And comprehensive reform still seems elusive no matter who controls Congress, Democrats or Republicans. I mean, it's hopeless with Republicans, don't get me wrong. But even with Democrats in charge of Congress, I don't see a lot of movement or comprehensive immigration reform.
How do you think, you know, Trump signaled a retreat, I think is wrong, but he, you know, from the world stage, but he was saying, you know, Europe should take care of Europe more than it does, you know, Asia is going to be, you know, a Chinese sphere of influence, and we need to be careful about that. Biden seems to be broadly going along with that. Do you think that's a better, broadly speaking, a better foreign policy than, you know, a kind of aggressive interventionist foreign policy?
You know, in my years in Congress, I was definitely more in the dovish camp, meaning not so far as like a Justin Amash, to be clear. But I was, you know, voting against defense spending, trying to cut it 3%, 5%, just it's like 40% of our money. And it's all like big part of its deficit spending. Now, that being said, I do think we should totally support Ukraine, NATO, European Union security. We cannot let Vladimir Putin get away with this kind of aggressive military attack. And in fact, some of our acquiescence to his previous military territorial expansions are what encouraged him to do this. So I guess where I would fall is I would say, look, we have a broad range of foreign policy, but when it comes to an invasion and military attack, I think the world should not stand for that. That is a direct oppression of freedom, obviously, on the people of Ukraine, of autonomy. We have to put our foot down somewhere, and I think Ukraine is where we put our
foot
down.
So does that mean actually putting troops there or supporting other efforts?
No. I mean, on this one, I think that President Biden is handling it, roughly right. I don't think committing American troops, I think making it as painful as possible for Russia, which we are through international institutions, certainly admitting Ukrainian refugees. But our hope is Ukrainian refugees, and many of them are, they can return now. Many of them are returning to Western Ukraine, Kyiv. They can't go back to Eastern Ukraine, supplying Ukraine with weapons. They are fighting on the front lines of freedom and democracy. I believe in liberal democracy. I'm against autocratic regimes, whether it is the milder autocratic regime of Donald Trump here or the more pernicious autocratic regime of Vladimir Putin.
Final two quick questions. What about China then? Is China a rival in the sense that we have to vanquish it, or do we learn to live with it? And what do we do about, what seems to be going on in China on a daily basis is as bad as anything happening in Ukraine? If you're a Uyghur, if you're a suspected COVID infected person, how do we deal with that?
They're a very important economic partner for the United States. I think that we also have, there's over 30 million people in the free independent nation of Taiwan, which we can't even say is a free independent nation because that's not politically correct.
We don't recognize it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that we make it clear that a military unification with Taiwan is unacceptable, just as reforming the Soviet Union through the military invasion of Ukraine or the Baltic states is unacceptable. Beyond that, I think we can absolutely try to complain about, from a human rights perspective, what China does within their own borders, to whether it's Tibet, whether it's the Uyghurs. But at the end of the day, we do respect the borders of their country. As long as they don't use a military option to invade other countries, I think a continued policy of engagement, just as it would be with the rest of the world, is probably the best policy in the interest of America.
Final question. You have two young kids. Looking forward 10 years down the road, are you optimistic about the country they're going to be growing up in and smiling and waving to me behind you?
I am. I'm optimistic on the environmental front. Cleaner air, the simple economics are leading to more and more electric vehicles. Coal power production is the most expensive way to produce power. That's why it's all on its way out. It's a question of when coal plants are retired. So I'm optimistic for cleaner air, for cleaner water, just with where the economics are driving it. Obviously, I worry about liberal democracy and freedom. We've always faced challenges, whether it was communism, whether it was Nazism, or whether it's today's sort of autocratic governments in Russia and Hungary and Belarus and other nations, China. We can never predict this, which will win out, but I will always put my money on liberal democracy.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Governor Jared Polis, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick. Take care.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.